From KCRW in Santa Monica and PRI, Public Radio International, this is To the Point.
Campaign promises aren't all made to be broken. Hello again, I'm Armin Alney, and this is To the Point. Candidate Trump said he'd build that wall on the Mexican border and crack down on sanctuary cities that harbor undocumented immigrants. As president, he is ordering implementation despite massive cost, dispute about whether America will be safer, and civil liberties issues. He doesn't need any new legislation to build the wall, but lawyers are lining up to argue about withholding federal money from sanctuary cities. It is still not clear what's in store for the Dreamers, those who were brought here illegally as children and don't know any other country. Later on today's Talking Point, can domestic and foreign policies be based on alternative facts? First, here's the news.
Listen to KCRW's music stream, Eclectic 24, for hand-picked music around the clock. You can find all of KCRW's produced content on our app. Download for free at kcrw.com/apps.
Support for To the Point comes from the members of KCRW and from the Public Radio International Program Fund.
Hello again, Norman Alney, back with To the Point. The Trump administration is getting off to a shaky start with disputes about alternative facts and traditional staffing. We'll hear more later on our Talking Point. First, this news update. Yesterday, President Trump said this about meeting with Mexico's chief executive, Enrique Peña Nieto, as scheduled for next Tuesday.
By working together on a positive trade, safe borders, and economic cooperation, I truly believe we can enhance the relation between our two nations to a degree not seen before, certainly in a very, very long time. I think our relationship with Mexico is going to get better.
That was yesterday. Here's the president today.
President of Mexico and myself have agreed to cancel our planned meeting scheduled for next week. Unless Mexico is going to treat the United States fairly, with respect, such a meeting would be fruitless, and I want to go a different route.
Now, before the president said that, at a Republican retreat in Philadelphia, Peña Nieto had said he'd canceled because of Trump's demand that Mexico pay for the wall on the border. Assam Ahmed is New York Times bureau chief for Mexico and Central America and the Caribbean, and it's great to have you back on our program. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So obviously, this is a tit-for-tat that's been going on for a long time, really since the Trump campaign began.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, Trump sort of launched his campaign by referring to certain Mexicans as rapists, and I think that was the first shot across the bow and kind of defined the relationship from there on.
So what about this issue about Mexico paying for the wall? The president keeps saying that. Now he's asking Congress to give him the money anyway, guaranteeing that he's still going to get the money out of Mexico. What sort of pressure does that put on Peña Nieto, who seems to be saying, forget it?
Yeah, I mean, Peña Nieto, his foreign minister, just about every person in his cabinet has said repeatedly they're not going to pay for the wall. At first, they thought it was a campaign ploy, but increasingly, it's starting to look like, you know, President Trump is a lot like, you know, the candidate Trump. It's not placing pressure in so much as I don't see the Mexican government.
Okay, apparently we're having a little trouble with the Skype connection there with Mexico City and Assam Ahmed. We will try to get it back. But once again, as I indicated, big change from what Trump said yesterday about meeting with the president of Mexico to what it was that he said today, and a great deal of background, of course, behind that, who ultimately will pay for the money. We'll be talking about this later on our main body of our program, and we'll want to find out as well at some point to how the Mexican public is responding to all of this. Clearly, Peña Nieto, the president of Mexico, does not want to make a move such as crossing the border, coming to meet with President Trump, as long as the president is making the kinds of statements that he did, including the claim that Mexico is going to that Mexico is not treating the United States fairly with respect, as we just heard the president said. Assam Ahmed, what about this business of treating Mexico fairly and with respect? What do those terms mean to the Mexican public and to Mexican politicians?
I think broadly speaking, it's Mexico that's felt it hasn't been treated fairly or with respect. I think if anything, you know, Peña Nieto is an unpopular president here. His approval ratings are hovering near the single digits. And yet, in the face of that unpopularity, he's kind of resisted taking the bait and resisted issuing his own broadsides against the Trump administration. So I think a lot of people here look at the idea that Mexico is not treating the U.S. fairly or with respect as something of a joke. Especially in the face of all this pressure for Peña Nieto to do more saber rattling, to do this rallying cry for nationalism, which would actually probably help his poll numbers, when in fact basically he's done the opposite and maintained sort of a demure posture in the face of provocation.
How did he come to be so disrespected?
How did Peña Nieto come to be so disrespected?
Yeah.
Well, he came to be so unpopular in Mexico. So he started off his administration with sort of a bang. He passed a bunch of economic reforms that economists and others had been saying Mexico needed to do for ages. And then abruptly after that, security concerns began to resurface in Mexico. And his administration seemed sort of tone deaf to it. Obviously, a lot of people remember the disappearance of the 43 students in Ayotzinapa and what many view as the bungled federal investigation into what happened. And, you know, certain segments of society even believe the government hasn't told the truth.
Okay, so nothing whatsoever to do with Trump then or the United States. But what were the goals of this meeting? Were they going to try to renegotiate NAFTA, for example?
So Trump's goal was to renegotiate NAFTA. Peña Nieto made clear for his own leverage that he wanted it to be about more than just NAFTA. NAFTA would be one part of an overall thing. Migration, for instance, Mexico has become a hub for Central American migrants trying to go to America. So sure. In linking that negotiation with NAFTA, I think the Peña Nieto administration felt like, okay, we're not going to just get steamrolled when it comes to NAFTA because they need us vis-a-vis immigration. So I think it was a broad package of negotiations.
Okay. All right. Awesome. Ahmed, it's great to have you with us. You get the perspective from Mexico City, once again with the New York Times for Mexico, Central America, and the Caribbean. We're going to take a look at it from an American perspective in a moment. Campaign promises that aren't all made to be broken. On To the Point from PRI.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
KCRW thanks Factiva from Dow Jones for its use of Factiva.com.
Well, we're only back with To the Point. Once again, President Trump has issued orders to implement that promise to build the Great Wall, as he's called it, on the Mexican border, and also to penalize cities and other localities that try to protect undocumented immigrants from being rounded up and deported, so-called sanctuary cities. Let's start with the wall. Law professor Stephen Legomski was chief counsel to the U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services Agency during part of the Obama administration. Professor, it's great to have you on our program. Thanks for joining us.
Oh, thank you for having me.
How different has Donald Trump's administration been now so far in the past few days from the Obama administration in this regard?
Well, it couldn't be night and day. Whichever side of the aisle one happens to be on, I think all would agree that these policies are very much in the opposite direction as those of the Obama administration. There were a number of actions announced over the last couple of days, either through official executive orders or through leaked memos that appear about to be announced. I would say the main elements of those are, one, the most visible of being the wall. Mr. Trump has instructed his cabinet officers to look for all possible funding sources for the wall and to plan and design and construct it. We'll see what happens with that. Second big thrust is more detentions. The order seems to imply that all people who are apprehended in the border area or even anywhere else who might be subject to deportation should be detained somewhere while they're waiting for their hearings, although the detention space for that is not yet available. One of the stranger things that he did, I think, was with respect to enforcement priorities. Under the Obama administration, there was a very specific set of priorities that officers were to follow with limited resources. The main thrust was go after people who have committed and been convicted of dangerous crimes, people who threaten national security, anyone found in the border area, and so on. But Mr. Trump has expanded that so that he now includes among the top priorities not only national security and public safety threats, but also people convicted of any crimes, people charged with any crimes, even people who have committed acts that the officials think constitute a crime, as well as anybody who was found in the U.S. without permission. All of these people are on the same plane in terms of enforcement priority. And I would say the last big thing, which has several pieces to it, is he's looking for ways in which to enhance federal and state cooperation in immigration law enforcement. Part of it is by entering into these agreements. They're called 287G agreements with state and local law enforcement officials, where the federal government would effectively deputize state and local police to investigate and arrest and apprehend and even detain people whom they suspect of being in the U.S. unlawfully. It would also reinstate a program called Secure Communities, whereby ICE would find out whether a person being held in a local jail is possibly removable, and if so, they could request the local authority to keep the person in detention for 2 days longer than would normally be the case. And the last thing is, and probably one of the most publicized, is a crackdown on so-called sanctuary jurisdictions, which Mr. Trump defines very specifically to mean any state or local government that has violated this one particular statute. It's a federal statute that prohibits governments from issuing orders that say you're not allowed to share any information on somebody's individual immigration status with the government. They can't do that, although there's nothing apparently in the order to prevent governments from simply saying you don't need to collect that information in the first place. There are a number of concerns about the state and local cooperation, which I'd be happy to talk about if you'd like me to.
When you say can't share information, those are state laws that prohibit the sharing of information. Is that correct?
Correct.
The states that want to be sanctuaries for undocumented immigrants.
Right. It could be state laws or local municipal laws.
Now, we just heard President Trump say that somehow there's going to be a different route for getting the payment of the for the wall. What routes are available at the moment? Have they been specific at all about where they're going to get the money if they don't get it from Mexico?
He's thrown out some suggestions. One of the things that happens is that many Mexican immigrants in the U.S. And many U.S. citizens of Mexican ancestry do send payments called remissions back to help out their family members back home. And Mr. Trump has talked about possibly putting a tax on those remissions. He's also talked about doing things like putting a tariff on Mexican goods in an attempt to pressure the Mexican government into helping to pay for the wall. But most observers, I think, are of the impression, are of the opinion that those things are very likely to materialize.
Okay, now here we have the governor of California in his most recent speech to the legislature delivering the budget saying this.
We must prepare for very uncertain times and reaffirm the basic principles that have made California the great exception that it is. In California, immigrants are an integral part of who we are and what we become.
So, Stephen Legomski, would you see that as a sort of declaration of political war on behalf of the governor of California?
Well, it's certainly an expression of disagreement. There are a couple of things that states like California and cities can do. They could choose to violate the particular statute that would make them sanctuary jurisdictions and thereby refrain from receiving certain federal grants, or they could comply with the letter of the law and say, okay, we'll share information if we happen to get it. But there's nothing in federal law that requires us to obtain this information on individual immigrants in the first place. And we won't do anything more than what the law requires.
Can the federal government, can the president deputize the state and local law enforcement authorities, or do they have to agree to that?
They have to agree to it. But many states and local governments did agree to it, both at the end of the Bush administration and at the beginning of the Obama administration. Toward the end of the Obama administration, these kinds of agreements were not really sought, and President Trump has indicated he'd like to revive them.
All right. Again, Stephen Ligomski, once again, was chief counsel at the U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services Agency under President Obama, says it's night and day now with Donald Trump. Josh Blackman is a professor of constitutional law at South Texas College of Law in Houston. He's also an adjunct scholar at the Cato Institute. He helped draft an amicus brief in the U.S. versus Texas, a case that involves much of the kinds of arguments we're talking about. Professor Blackman, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you for having me back.
Where are we now, then, if, in fact, things have changed from night to day? What are the chances of building the law, the wall, rather? And what are the prospects for cities, local communities, and others that want to be sanctuaries for undocumented immigrants?
Well, so the number one question is about federalism. And I think what we're seeing now is, in many respects, everyone's switching sides. Like, you know, in a Jane Austen movie where you have the two parties dancing and at the clap of the hand, everyone switches sides and continue on as if nothing had happened. So now progressive states that for years have railed against federalism and challenged Texas's assertion of sovereignty are now asserting much the same, which is par for the course. It's politics. So the major question to ask is, what happens if Trump indeed does withhold various federal grants from cities and states that have these sanctuary policies? Yesterday, the New York Times had a report that New York City stood to lose about $9 million in federal grants. New York City's budget—
$9
million? Million with an M.
That's peanuts.
Peanuts. Mm-hmm. New York City's budget is about $9 billion with a B. So we're talking about 0.1%. And under the Supreme Court's case law, withholding an amount that's peanuts is not in any respect coercive, and it's not unconstitutional. So they can kick and scream, and they can lose $9 million and go on with their lives, and that's the end of the case because the government cannot commandeer states to comply. The bigger issue has to do with policies that are actually thwarting federal policy, and this is a bit of irony. A few years ago, the Supreme Court heard the Arizona versus United States case. This is the Show Me Your Papers case. And the Obama administration went to court saying that Arizona's law interfered with federal policy. And the court agreed, and they actually struck down some of Arizona's laws. Now it's the exact reverse. The DOJ, under this executive order, can sue California and say their sanctuary policy interferes with federal law, which it most certainly does. So it's a weird place where you can't tell the states what to do, but courts have now asserted the power to strike down laws that actually interfere with federal policy. So there's going to be this weird weird reckoning with federalism that I think people will slowly realize over the next couple of months and years.
Stephen Ligomski, back to you. You were with the Obama administration, and of course the legislature in California has hired the former Obama Attorney General Eric Holder to try to get involved in exactly the kinds of things that we are hearing. Do you agree with Josh Blackman that before we see any action, we're going to see a whole lot of action on the border, or with regard to the sanctuary cities, we're going to see a whole lot of action in court? Stephen Ligomski, you're with us?
Well, I'm sorry. Can you hear me better now?
Yes, I can. Thank
sorry
you.
About it. Yeah, I have a lot of respect for Josh. He and I are typically on opposite sides of the issue, but I do agree with him that there's likely to be a good deal of litigation, a good deal of political back and forth, and a good deal of dispute over where the funding for these different mechanisms is going to come from, if at all. So I think we are in for a period of some turmoil.
And how many states do you think are likely to challenge, in addition to California? And, you know, maybe New York City won't if it's only $9 million, but with California, we got a lot more.
Very difficult to say. I think some of the immigrant-heavy states, like California, Illinois, New York, would be the most logical candidates for such challenges. But more likely, I think, is that it would be the federal government bringing an action against the states and the states defending against something like an attempted withdrawal of federal grant funds.
It's difficult to say how those will turn out, but my guess is that that's where most of the action will be.
Josh Blackman, in California, and I'm sure in other states as well, there are counties and cities that have declared themselves to be sanctuaries, some of which are quite small. There's a big city in Los Angeles County called Cudahy, and I'm sure it doesn't have anything close to a $9 million budget. Could the federal government zero in on those and try to make the case there in a situation which really would hurt?
Yes, they can. So the same sort of suit that the Justice Department brought against Arizona can be brought against the sanctuary cities. In fact, I had a piece in National Review about a week ago making just this point. And under the Arizona precedent, if these cities are actively thwarting federal policy, so let's give you an example. In the past, when the federal government issued what's called a detainer, which basically means you state prison or city prison, you have someone here who's illegal, and we want to collect them because we suspect them of a crime. In the past, many jails would simply hand the person over. Part of what a sanctuary city means is that the feds will not, the state police will not turn over a suspect in a crime absent a warrant from a judge. A judge can only issue a warrant that there's probable cause of a crime. And they've actually argued that it violates the Fourth Amendment to seize a person and hand them to the feds unless there's a warrant. And some courts have actually upheld this sort of practice. But I think we're going to actually see a lot of litigation about states that are actively interfering with federal law enforcement mechanisms when they suspect someone is a criminal. And I should note, the Trump executive order wasn't just applicable to people who were convicted of crimes, but even people who were accused of crimes are now prioritized for removal. So that expands the scope of people who have not even had a trial yet, who can then be subject to deportation.
What about what are referred to as DACA and DAPA? Josh Blackman, tell us about those.
So DACA, D-A-C-A, was a 2012 program from President Obama that put on hold the deportation of the Dreamers, these minors who came to the country without authorization and stuck around, were generally good people, didn't break any laws. And the government said, okay, we will give you, as a matter of executive discretion, work authorization, and we will put you in the bottom of the line for removal. DACA is still in effect, and in fact, I've read that they're still taking applications, although that may change soon. DAPA, D-A-P-A, D-A-P-A, is it there?
Yes, we're here.
Okay, sorry. D-A-P-A, the 2014 program, would have put on hold the deportation of the parents of U.S. citizens. This policy never went into effect because of litigation brought by the state of Texas, and as you noted, I filed a brief in support of Texas's case. And this policy will likely be revoked in the very near future.
Okay. So a lot of legalism here and a lot of issues to be litigated, perhaps over a long period of time. Let me introduce somebody who is more intimately involved in what this might mean. Mike Stoker is an attorney. He's a former member of the Santa Barbara County Board of Supervisors here in California. He's a former chairman of the Agricultural Labor Relations Board for the state. We just have a moment before we go to the break, Mike Stoker, but what I want to hear from you is whether you are glad under these circumstances or not now that the administrations have changed.
Well, thank you, Warren. It's a pleasure to be with you. I'm very glad. I mean, first of all, you go back, that was bipartisan. The money to build that has been appropriated in a bipartisan way going back to 9/11 attacks. And if you listen to the experts on this, the Border Patrol, they all conclude that a wall, both virtual and physical, is needed not to even deal with the immigration issues in terms of people coming here for labor, but the security of this country for a lot of people that want to do harm to this country. And the irony is now we're debating how's it going to be funded, and everybody's almost implying, even the people that are opposing Trump, that the wall's going to be built. And we've been trying to build this wall since 2000. You heard some comments earlier on potential funds from remissions, for money that goes back to Mexico,
okay.
Potential tariffs.
I got to interrupt you. I'm sorry. As I indicated, we need to go to a break. We'll get a sense that we are going to have a supporter of Donald Trump on this program. We'll hear more from Mike Stoker later and others as well. And our talking point, can domestic and foreign policies be based on alternative facts? This is To the Point from PRI.
Subscribe to the To The Point podcast at kcrw.com or download the KCRW app, available anywhere podcasts are found and on all mobile devices.
We're not only back with To The Point, once again talking about the night-to-day change on immigration policy from Obama to Trump and what that might mean for a long time from a legal standpoint for the federal government, for states, for sanctuary cities. We'll get back to that issue as we go along. But we're talking now with Mike Stoker, once again, a supporter of the wall, former member of the Santa Barbara County Board of Supervisors here in California, former chairman of the Agricultural Labor Relations Board in California. Mike Stoker, isn't one of your major goals and that of others here in California to get an immigration system that allows some sort of a program whereby agricultural workers can come to the United States from Mexico legally and easily? Don't you want to see order? Isn't that what you're really looking for?
Absolutely. And you know, Warren, I think for the first time in 25 years, we have a chance to accomplish it. I'm on the executive committee of the Agricultural Coalition of Immigration Reform, Immigration Reform out of Washington. Your agricultural leaders, I've been fighting for 25 years for immigration reform. I testified before Congress as chairman of the Ag Labor Relations Board in 1995. I've supported 12 different versions. And I think the ultimate irony is we have a chance with Trump for the following reasons. A lot of Democrats who claim they care about immigration reform could care less about the workers. They want only immigration reform with citizenship because they want the 11 million people here that are here illegally to be able to vote because they're assuming they're going to vote Democrat. And that's only going to happen with a Democrat president, Democrats being able to get 60 votes in the Senate and controlling the House. On the other hand, you have a lot of Republicans that have always supported and have been willing to look at a work visa type program, a guest worker program that allows a 3 to 4 year work permit, green card. You go back to your country of origin for 30 days after it expires, and you come back and you can renew to successive terms. That, I think, program can pass in the House. I think it can pass in the Senate. And I can't speak for the Trump administration. I feel very, very good that they would sign it for the following reasons, and this ties into sanctuary cities. And it's important to make this distinguishment because a lot of people, for political reasons, are trying to imply that this fight for sanctuary cities is a fight for all the people here illegally. It's not. It's sanctuary cities is fighting for people that are here illegally and who have committed crimes or are accused of committing crimes and whether they're going to cooperate with federal agencies in regards to those individuals. I think politically, a lot of those constituents and those potential sanctuary cities, when they find out they're losing money, not for fighting for those hardworking people that are here illegally that haven't committed crimes, but those that are here illegally that have committed crimes. And I'll go back to Donald Trump's own words in the 60-minute interview right after he was sworn or after he was elected president. When he talked about the focus needs to be on the people that are here illegally that have committed crimes, and that the people that haven't committed those crimes that are here illegally, in his own words, are good, hard-working people. So I think the sanctuary cities is an issue that we need to focus in on, that's focusing not on people here illegally that haven't committed crimes. And back to DACA, you mentioned that earlier. Yesterday were two executive orders to deal with immigration reform. DACA was not eliminated. In a stroke of a pen, if the president wanted to eliminate DACA, he could have done it yesterday, and he didn't. So I think what you have is really three-prong approach to what's going on right now, which I think is very healthy for immigration reform. One, secure the borders, and that's the wall. Secondly, focus in on people here illegally that have committed crimes. And thirdly, let's put off focusing on how do we, in a rational, humanistic way, deal with those that are here illegally that haven't committed crimes. That's the DACA group. Those are the people that are working in the fields and in places like that. And I think ultimately we have the best chance for immigration reform with legal status, not citizenship, which means that finally a lot of us that have fought this battle for 25 years, and who would have thought that the best chance of it happening would be with a Trump administration being sworn in. But that's the way it's lining up. I haven't felt this optimistic in over 15 years. By the way, we almost passed it back with President Bush and then 9/11 hit.
Okay.
And that's when we lost our opportunity.
All right, Mike Stoker, once again, formerly a supervisor in Santa Barbara County in California and a one-time chair of the California Agricultural Labor Relations Board. Something was actually begun by our current governor in his earlier term back in the 1970s. Maria Elena Incapié is the executive director of the National Immigration Law Center, and it's great to have you on our program. Thanks for joining
us. Thanks, Warren. Great to be back.
What do you say to what we just heard from Mike Stoker, obviously a big supporter of what Donald Trump is doing?
Yeah, so unfortunately, the immigrant and refugee community definitely is experiencing this very different. And if you look at not just what Donald Trump has said during the election campaign, but since he became president, and then most importantly, what the executive orders actually say, as Steve summarized, if this were only about individuals who have been convicted of a crime, that's what President Obama has been doing. That was the priority under President Obama, as Steve mentioned, and that was already problematic for many different reasons. But what this executive order actually is saying is that there aren't priorities anymore. It explicitly says that anyone who has entered without authorization, who didn't come with papers, who overstayed their visas, are considered now a national security and public safety risk. And again, the fact that in this country we're now saying if you've been charged with a crime, even if you haven't been convicted, you also are a priority. What happened to innocence until proven guilty? So there's a lot in the executive orders that actually have sent a great message of fear, and that these are actually much more extremist. They're expensive. They're going to be ineffective. The fact that the border, on the one hand, until we are addressing root causes of migration, the reason why people from Central America, for example, are coming is not because they simply want to come for a better life economics. They're actually fleeing violence. They're fleeing gender violence and epidemic levels of femicide, for example, in Honduras, Guatemala, and El Salvador. So people will continue to flee Central America just as the way that they're fleeing Syria. And the
well, what about Mexico? That's Central America, but don't most of them come from Mexico? Or isn't there a larger number? And aren't the people who are here in this country, the 11 or 12 million or so, more largely from Mexico rather than from Central America?
So in terms of people who are coming over now or who have been coming over in recent years, Warren, actually it isn't from Mexico. There's net zero migration from Mexico. The majority is actually coming from Central America. That said, though, as you mentioned, the number of undocumented immigrants in the United States who are undocumented, who are, in California in particular, they're integral members of our society, of our communities. Mm-hmm. They're helping out in schools. They're taking care of our children, our farms, et cetera. They are now petrified of what a Donald Trump agenda means, particularly because it wasn't just rhetoric. What Donald Trump's agenda as part of these executive orders signify is that he is ready to create the deportation force that he threatened about, and now it's actually in executive orders.
All right. Back to what you said before. You said whatever happened to innocence until you're proven guilty. People who are not citizens, as I understand it, are not entitled to the civil rights that citizens are. So what's your argument then in response to what we heard from Mike Stoker, that what really Democrats want is more Democrats, and what they're trying to do is keep people in this country, whether they happen to be criminals or not, so that they'll have more votes and turn elections, particularly in those border states?
So first, just to clarify, Warren, actually in our country, it's the beauty of our Constitution, and as a lawyer, I especially appreciate that our Constitution actually says yes. All individuals in the United States, regardless of where you were born or whether you have documents or not and are undocumented or a citizen, you are protected by our civil rights.
Okay.
You are protected by our Constitution. So that's I want to make sure that's clear both to our listeners, including undocumented immigrants out there. Second is I disagree with Mike. I think that the Democratic Party may have its own interests about why they want undocumented immigrants to become citizens or not, but the fact is that as a country, we believe that individuals should participate in democracy. And I think there's a false misperception out there by both the Republican and Democratic Party that undocumented immigrants are automatically going to become part of the Democratic Party. Many immigrants are actually socially conservative or otherwise conservative and would be part of the Republican Party or the Green Party or some other party. But the problem right now that we have is that because the Republican Party, particularly as you hear from Donald Trump, has become so anti-immigrant, so anti-refugee, the fact that the leaked executive orders actually say that we may be suspending the refugee program altogether, that Syrian refugees may be completely blocked from entering the United States again indefinitely, that is dangerous. That actually is placing our country in greater harm. So those reasons, that is why Mexican immigrants in the United States and many other immigrants in the United States are prioritizing immigration. Most immigrants have an undocumented family member. 85% of immigrants live in what's called a mixed status family, where we have U.S. citizens, undocumented immigrants, people with green cards, et cetera.
Let me go back to Mike Stoker. Let's stipulate that you disagree with regard to the political aspect of this. But what about the fact that the Trump administration has extended the net beyond people who have committed crimes, just to people who have only been accused of crimes, even though they haven't been convicted of anything? And what about the other arguments that we have heard from Maria Elena Incapié?
Well, I mean, number one, again, I think you heard her say everybody's concerned about and they're afraid of and this and that. We could have had an executive order yesterday eliminating DACA. It didn't happen. We could have had some executive orders that would have – we could be having raids today in all our factories, our farms. It's not happening. And a lot of people are playing the politics of this. And I think the bottom line is this. Let's see how it plays out. I will bet you that within the next 3 to 4 or 5 months, you are going to have on the table something from the Republicans that the Trump administration would support that ultimately would allow for the people here that are illegally, that haven't committed any crimes, to be able to have an avenue to stay in this country legally. That's called legal status. When I was talking about the politics this earlier, Nancy Pelosi has said she will never support an immigration reform package that only allows legal status. She wants pathway to citizenship. I can tell you all those farm workers that I work with, and I've been working with them for 25 years, the majority of them, well over 90, 95%, could care less whether they're a U.S. citizen or not. They just want to be able to come out from the shadows and from the underground culture they're forced to live in.
Okay. I'm going to interrupt you just simply in the interest of time. You're talking about now agricultural workers. Maria Elena Incapié, you were talking earlier about people from Central America who are, in fact, refugees. But what do you say to the idea of having a system such as I guess the Bracero program was the model for it that we had way back when Governor Brown's father was governor and even before that. Is that something that you could live with if, in fact, the Republicans decided that that was their idea of immigration reform, even though it didn't lead necessarily to citizenship?
So, Warren, the reason that the Bracero program was eliminated was because the Department of Labor at that time, the U.S. Department of Labor, actually terminated the program because there was evidence of slavery-like conditions. So, no, I do not support a Bracero-like program or a massive guest worker program. However, I do agree with Mike that many immigrants, actually, if you ask them, most immigrants want a handful of things. They want to be able to live free without the fear of deportation. Second, they want to be able to work lawfully. Third, they want a driver's license to be able to move freely and drive their children to school. And lastly, they want to be able to travel back home to their home country to visit their mother or father before they pass away. So those are some basic human rights that every immigrant wants
to be able to
have. So,
Mark Stoker, would the program that you're suggesting Republicans might go for include all those things?
Well, yeah. The bottom line is what she just mentioned about the Bracero program was in the 1950s when the labor conditions were nowhere where they are right now.
But would the new deal, and I'm sorry I brought that up because it is ancient history, but would the new deal allow the kind of mobility that Ms. Incapié suggests is needed?
I think there's a very good chance of it. I started the show with my comment saying there's a three-prong. Secure the border, that's the wall.
Okay.
Secondly, as to round up, to focus on only people that are here illegally, and I think the third component can be, is going to be some type of work permit that we would be able to have legal status and be able to deal with all the concerns that were negative for the Bracero program because labor conditions have changed.
Okay, got it. Josh Blackman, I want to go back to you. We're almost out of time. Again, at South Texas College of Law in Houston, you were with us earlier in the program. What do you think of what Mr. Stoker has said about the possibility of actually working something out and having some sort of agreement coming from the Trump administration?
It will be a big lift. The Democrats have little incentive to go along with these sorts of programs, I think, as a matter of policy. But from a constitutional perspective, they will be kicking and screaming and fighting tooth and nail. And I think we'll see challenges in the federal courts very soon concerning the scope of what President Trump can do to nudge the states to comply with in terms of federal money.
So we're back to the issue of court actions. Stephen Legomski, again from our earlier program, or earlier part of the program, formerly the chief counsel at the U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services Agency under the Obama administration, the one who said that it's night and day between Obama and Trump. What about it? Do you see any possibility for working things out there, or is this going to continue?
I think there is a possibility. Really, in 2013, and I was proud to be part of that effort, the Senate, overwhelmingly by a bipartisan majority of 68-32, enacted a comprehensive reform package that included actually much of what Mike was proposing, a very generous program for agricultural workers, massive, massive increases in both and resources for both border and interior enforcement, and they passed a lawful permanent resident status. It wouldn't happen until more than 10 years after the legislation was passed, and then it would be several more years before people could attain citizenship, and it also reformed some of the outdated criteria for legal immigration. All the seasoned vote counters on Capitol Hill were pretty confident that the House, that there was a majority for that bill in the House, if only they were permitted to vote. But because of a revolt from the Tea Party, Speaker Boehner refused to allow the House members to vote. My guess is that now that we have a Republican president, the Democrats in the House, pardon me, the Republicans in the House might be a little bit less reticent to do something that would give credit to the president. And so if something would give credit to a Republican president, it might be that some of the members who voted against the 2013 bill would be in favor now. So ironically, even though we have a president whose immigration policies are quite extreme, that might in fact increase the chances of comprehensive immigration reform, and I would love to see something like that happen.
All right. At least a glimmer of light, perhaps, at the end of the tunnel, something somewhat unexpected given this subject, and we'll see what happens. Stephen Legomski again, now at the University of Washington University School of Law, formerly with the Obama administration. Josh Blackman at the South Texas College of Law in Houston, also with the Cato Institute. Mike Stoker, a former Santa Barbara County Board of Supervisor at here in California, and Maria Elena Incapier, the Executive Director of the National Immigration Law Center. It's great to talk with you all, and thank you very much for being with us. In a moment, alternative facts and the power of the presidency on To the Point from Public Radio International.
Share your comments about today's show at kcrw.com/to the point or join the conversation on our Facebook page. You can also follow us on Twitter at @to_the_point_KCRW.
Warren Alney here with today's Talking Point. Secretary of State Rex Tillerson has no experience running the department that oversees foreign policy, and today the entire management team has either resigned or been asked to resign. That's according to the Washington Post. With us is Karen Tumulty. She's national political correspondent for the Washington Post. She has been writing about something else, which we will talk about in a moment, and that is the question of whether you can have government untethered from truth. But tell us, first of all, about what's happening at the Department of State, and do we know, were these very top-level people asked to resign, or did they do it on their own?
Well, it is a sort of complicated thing to explain. Basically, these are all career foreign service officers, but they are in political appointee positions, the top level positions at the State Department, and it is sort of pro forma between administrations for all political appointees to submit letters of resignation. But most often when you have people in these kinds of jobs, which are basically just, you know, managing the operations of an agency, you know, those letters of resignation are not accepted. In this case, they have been. So you can both argue that they resigned and they were fired because, after all, these are diplomats, so they're going to do things diplomatically. Everybody gets to sort of say what they want to say of it. The most significant one of them, the most senior one, is the undersecretary for management, a guy named Patrick Kennedy. And he has been, I believe, believe he's been there for more than 40 years, but he had been, he had kind of had a target on his back because he had been part of the defense of then Secretary of State Clinton over her handling of the attacks on the diplomatic compound in Benghazi, Libya, and had also been involved in some of the security classifications of the emails on her private server. So this was a guy who probably knew he was not going to last very long in a Trump administration.
So is this then something more routine, and in his case especially political, and is it premature to say that Rex Tillerson is going to be left with a department and nobody who knows how to run it?
All of these things are true. It is this is to essentially have your top echelon of experienced managers suddenly disappear when you are coming in. Rex Tillerson, mind you, is the only Secretary of State in modern history who has absolutely no experience in government, much less the State Department. So that is both unusual and potentially problematic.
Okay. I don't know to what extent this relates to the column that you wrote that's gotten so much attention about whether you can have government run untethered from the truth, but that's an interesting way to put it, as they did in the headline. I don't suppose you wrote the headline, but
it was in my story as well.
Okay, well, I guess it was, and I just failed to underline
untethered
it.
Untethered from the facts.
Okay, so what did you mean by that, and what issue are you raising about the new Trump administration?
Well, there are a couple of things that have happened, and mind you, this is only what we're into day six now. A couple of things. On their first full work day, the president and his press secretary spent a lot of energy contesting the crowd size at the inauguration. It was sort of a trivial thing to get into a fight over. It was also something where the evidence, the facts, the photographs were not on their side. But then, a couple of days later, we see them engaging in something that is actually far more serious, which is the president's allegation that there were millions of illegal ballots cast in the election. Mind you, he's essentially contesting the results of an election that he won. But
only in the states that he lost, apparently. That's the only place he wants to see the investigation.
Yes. And also, apparently, every single one of these illegal ballots, in his view, was cast for Hillary Clinton. There is not only no evidence to support these statements, but there's a lot of academic studies, and there's also the word of secretaries of state in states across the country that there are no major sorts of irregularities of the type that the president was talking about. Now, why this is significant is that it really does kind of undermine people's faith in the integrity of our electoral system, which is a pretty big deal. And it also suggests that Donald Trump's pattern of engaging in conspiracy theories and saying things that were just simply not true, a pattern that we saw during the campaign is continuing into his presidency. And that is more serious because we are also seeing him putting the resources and the weight of the presidency behind these false contentions.
You've talked about talked with people that worked in the George W. Bush administration, and they've indicated some of the scenarios that might take place. Tell us a bit about the kind of thing, hypothetically at least, that they're worried about if this sort of pattern continues.
Well, it's one thing for people during a campaign to say, oh, that's just the way Donald Trump talks. But if people cannot trust him, and especially people who did not support him in the election, cannot trust him to be essentially dealing straight with them on more serious issues, that's a real problem.
Like,
I mean, what about, God forbid there's some kind of terrorist incident or terrorist threat? What if he is asking the country to make some kind of, sacrifice on the basis of an economic plan or something? What if he is trying to explain a new policy? That is where, you cannot be known as fast and loose with the facts. And mind you, there are presidents who ultimately get caught in having not told the truth, whether it was George Bush on weapons of mass destruction going into Iraq or Barack Obama telling you that if you like your plan, you can keep it. Those are the kinds of things that really undermine a presidency. But what we see here is a new president essentially leading with telling falsehoods right out of the gate in his presidency, and really over, in the case of the crowd sizes, some really trivial stuff that he just won't let go of.
Okay, we started out talking about the State Department in a very different context, but do we know how this is all going down overseas at the moment with other countries?
Well, we have today a big flap where the president of Mexico has canceled his visit, but Donald Trump says, maybe I should cancel it beforehand. So we have a little, exercise here.
But there's no quarrel about the facts there, is there?
But there is. I think there is a lot of concern overseas about whether and when to take this man at his word. And when he says something, is it a policy position or is it just an opening negotiating position?
Are we in a place now in this country, though, pardon me, where people simply don't necessarily believe the same fact?
I think that, yes, you could definitely argue that in this regard, at least, the Trump presidency is sort of the product of a culture, and specifically a media culture, where people decide what reality they want to live in and sort themselves. If you're a conservative, you watch Fox, and if you're a liberal, you watch MSNBC.
So clearly, then the president is part of a culture in this regard. But you're suggesting that he's carrying it a bit too far as the making of policy, or he might anyway, the making of policy is concerned. So we will watch and see what happens. In the meantime, it's great to talk with you as always.
Good to talk to you too, Warren.
Okay, Karen Tumulty, once again, national political correspondent at The Washington Post. I'm Warren Olney. Join us again for To the Point, produced live and podcast. It's a co-production of KCRW Santa Monica and Public Radio International.
PRI, Public Radio International.